Good afternoon. It's Thursday, September the 17th, and from CITR News, this is the Dinner Report. Welcome to a special edition of the program today. I'm your host tonight, Ian Gunn. Coming up on the program, Joe Clark on the Constitution. The Federal Minister of Constitutional Affairs began selling his constitutional package today here at UBC with a speech to law students, and you will hear all of his speech in the next half hour, coming up on the Dinner Report for Thursday. On October the 26th, Canadians will go to the polls to vote on the Charlottetown Accord, an agreement drafted by the country's provincial, federal, and native leaders last month, which they hope will bring to an end more than 20 years of trying to complete the Canadian Constitution. The main architect of that agreement was Joe Clark, the Federal Minister of Constitutional Affairs, and with the agreement now on paper and the referendum called, Mr. Clark is on the road trying to sell his package in the face of what appears to be mounting opposition to the accord. He began his road swing this morning here at UBC with a speech to about 200 first-year students and a large crowd of reporters. As Mr. Clark explained to reporters after the speech, it's no coincidence that he should start in Vancouver. He said clearly that after Quebec, BC is the province that his government is most worried will reject the agreement in the October vote. CITR News was at Mr. Clark's speech this morning, and today on the Dinner Report, we broadcast that speech for you intact as he gave it earlier today. Here then, as introduced by the Dean of Law here at UBC, Dr. C. Lynn Smith, is the Right Honourable Joe Clark, President of the Privy Council and Minister responsible for Constitutional Affairs.
Thank you very much, Dean Smith. I thank you in particular for not making reference to my undistinguished career as a law student at the University of British Columbia. This will probably be one of my longest stays at UBC. And let that be a warning to others of you who think you can get through your law studies with that kind of intermittent attendance at class. I'm very pleased to be here. I want to try to make my opening remarks as brief as I can, but there are also some things I want to say to get on the record. I came here in part because I knew there were always television cameras here, and there's the off chance that if I'd said something on the record to you here, some version of it might appear on some international network of CBC, probably rebroadcast in Swahili. So I'm. I remember in the late 1960s when I had the great privilege of working for the Honorable Robert Stanfield, who was then the leader of the opposition. We went to a political meeting in Victoria, and it was a spring day, which is to say January in Victoria. And as we drew near the hall, the school where Mr. Stanfield was to be speaking, I noticed that there were few cars around the school and lots of people out working in their gardens. Now, you have to break these things gently to a national political leader, and I said, Mr. Stanfield, there may not be many people at our meeting tonight. And he said, isn't it encouraging to see how many people in Victoria have their priorities right? One of the features of a country like Canada is that we are used to being able to pursue our own priorities, being left alone to build our lives without the worries of war or of famine or of political systems that can come apart. But for Canadians, things are not like that now. On October the 26th, this country will either decide to come together or, in my view, begin to drift apart. Some people pretend that that decision will have no real consequence, that nothing will change, I disagree as strongly as I can. I have been at the heart of this process, and because of that, in a sense, at the heart of this country for the last 18 months. If we accept this accord, I believe, the constitutional issue will move to the back burner, and Canada can get on with other business. If we reject it, I believe, this country will gradually come apart, and maybe not so gradually. The Charlottetown Accord is a unanimous agreement that comes after literally decades of fighting and of failure. For the first time in Canadian history, at the most inclusive Canadian table ever, 17 Canadian leaders came together to support each other, to support our country, to build our future. They agreed on the most comprehensive package of reform this country has ever seen since Confederation. And they did that together, and I emphasize this because it is a rare phenomenon in Canada, they did it with unanimity, and a unanimity that was genuine, that came not because arms were twisted in the background, but because people were seeking consensus and compromise around a table. This agreement deals with every major constitutional issue of the past decade. And it does that in a rather particular Canadian way. It does that by balancing principles. There may be some easy countries in the world where you can simply take one principle and say, everything will be governed that way. We've never been quite that uncomplicated as a country. We have here, for example, a view of Canada as a nation of 10 equal provinces. And we have another view of Canada, equally valid, as a nation of two founding cultural communities, not to mention the Aboriginal people. We have a demand for an equal Senate based upon equality of representation. And we have a demand for representation by population. How do you combine the two in one system? We have a demand, understandable in the long history of Canada, for the inherent right of Aboriginal self-government. We have an insistence that it not establish any international rights. So what did we do? We balanced the idea of equal provinces and founding cultures. We balanced the idea of an equal Senate and getting as close to representation by population as we can. Even the equal Senate, bear in mind, is equal for 10 provinces, but not for each of the territories, and has, if you want to be strictly faithful to equality, an additional change in that there will be a number to be determined later of Aboriginal senators, a departure from a pure principle, not pure, but workable. We have Aboriginal self-government within Canada. Most countries in the world can't embrace difference. Some countries in the world try to erase difference. What's distinct about us, and has been through our long history, often unconsciously, is that we have been prepared to say, yes, there are different ways of looking at this country, and yes, we have to try to bring them all together. I believe the Canadian genius is to balance different principles fairly, and naturally as one of the architects of this particular agreement, you won't be surprised that I think that we have done as good a job at that as is capable of being done at this time in the life of Canada. For the first time ever, we have agreed on a fundamental reform of our Parliament. The Harcourt formula for the House of Commons will make that House reflect better the voice of the people by ensuring that every province will have at least 95% of the seats that it would have under strict application of the idea of representation by population, which has never been strictly applied ever in Canada before. All we can do is come as close as we can. And with the formula put forward by the Premier of this province, we have a way to deal with that province, that problem that ensures, for example, that British Columbia will be always within 95% of where it would have been by rep by pop. It's a little less attractive an arrangement for Ontario. It serves British Columbia's interests better than it does Ontario's, but Ontario has been prepared to accept that as part of the Canadian compromise. An equal Senate will reflect better the voices of the provinces. And both houses and the Constitution will respect what Premier Clyde Wells called the third equality, equality between the English and the French-speaking cultures, which has been part of this, the history of this country for at least two centuries. That is Premier Wells' word, not my own, although I'm pleased to have had him say it and pleased to quote it. For the first time ever, we have agreed to put in place a new partnership between Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people, one that would put the energies of Aboriginals to work for themselves, for Canada. For the first time ever, we have agreed to state and to celebrate the principles of our social union, of Medicare, of social services, of education, of the integrity of the environment. For the first time ever, we have agreed unanimously to say yes to Quebec and to give it the instruments it needs to have confidence as a minority in a large country on a large continent that speaks mostly English. And we have done that without special status. We've done that by treating every province the same. For the first time ever, we have agreed that provinces like British Columbia, like Alberta, like Quebec, are better able than Ottawa is to provide leadership in particular fields, like training, like tourism, like mining, like a number of others that are named. And for the first time ever, we have agreed on an inclusive statement of shared Canadian characteristics and values, of democracy, of the rule of law, of federalism, of the rights of the Aboriginals, of the recognition of Quebec's distinctness, of linguistic duality, of the equality of races, of individuals, of gender, of provinces. Now, this is not tinkering. This is far-reaching, fundamental reform that is agreed and that can happen this year. It keeps promises that were made before and broken. It keeps reforms that were started before and failed. It goes further than any constitutional agreement this century. And it is genuinely a Canada round, resolving several Canadian issues together. Il ne s'agit pas de bricolage. Voilà des réformes d'envergure, des réformes fondamentales qui ont fait l'unanimité et pourraient même entrer en vigueur dès cette année. C'est l'aboutissement de réformes amorcées déjà, mais abandonnées. On a comparé cette entente avec, aux propositions gouvernementales du septembre dernier et au rapport du comité Baudouin-Dauby en février dernier. On l'a mis au regard des positions de négociation des provinces et des opinions exprimées par les groupes de pression et les élites de tout genre. Cette entente va plus loin que toute autre entente constitutionnelle du siècle actuel. Think of this. 10 years ago, there was a constitutional agreement in 1982. Quebec was left out. Not a single political party in the province of Quebec, federalist or otherwise, supported that agreement. In Meech Lake, Aboriginal Canadians felt left out. So did many Western Canadians. So did many others. This agreement brings them in as it brings Quebec in from the exclusion of 1982. Many issues dealt with here have never been addressed before. Not the social charter, not the economic union, not this division of powers, not reform of the House of Commons and Senate. This agreement addresses all of that and more. And it does that by expressing a new vision of Canada. The Constitution we now have comes from another time, literally another century. A century in which Canada was a country concentrated on the Atlantic coast, a country that saw itself as European and white, a country that treated its Aboriginals as savages or as children. That Canada has not existed in fact for years. Our Constitution needs to catch up to our modern country. The Charlottetown Accord does that. It's substantial reform. Now, many of you might have written a different agreement. I might have done that myself if I'd been in the room by myself. But I wasn't in the room by myself. And the point is that no Canadian is. We're in this together. The very strength of this agreement lies in the fact that it is not the product of one set of hands, one level of government, one vision of Canada. Its strength is in the shared authorship, the many hands, the many visions that are part of this Canada Accord for the whole country. Now, of course, it's not perfect. If the Fathers of Confederation had insisted on perfection, or if they had been asked to buy some pre-packaged vision of Canada, there would have been no Confederation. But that is not what happened at Charlottetown then, and that is not what happened at Charlottetown last month. We have failed as a country when we did not balance views and balance interests. We have succeeded as a country when we do. The Charlottetown Agreement does that for the Canada of 1992. It's the responsibility now, and I emphasize that word responsibility, of Canadians to judge this agreement for yourselves. This is too important to be left to leaders, certainly too important to be left to interest groups who might focus as much on a cause as on a country. This agreement will be made available across the country. Voting on this is your right. Voting with knowledge is your responsibility. It's pretty straightforward. It hasn't been through all the lawyers yet, so it's pretty straightforward still. It's not written in Morse code. Canadians can understand it. I hope you'll read it yourselves. I hope you'll judge it yourselves. And I hope you'll judge it on its own terms. This is not a loyalty test. Canadians are being asked to vote on an agreement, not to take an oath of allegiance. There are reasonable, good Canadians who are troubled by parts of this agreement. They have every right to vote it down if they honestly believe that would help the country. But that's a serious decision, and there are serious issues to face. First, people who criticize this agreement should ask themselves if they think there is another agreement just around the corner, some kind of plan B for Canada. I suppose anything is possible. But remember, this comes after 2 years of committees and consultations and conferences and conversations. It comes after hundreds of hours of meetings over dozens of days. It comes after looking at dozens of options, hundreds of proposals and models and measures. None of them worked as well as this does. I suspect the choice is not between this accord and some other. The choice is probably between this accord and none at all. It's easy to find flaws, but surely the fundamental question is, with all of its flaws, does this agreement offer the prospect of moving the whole country forward? I firmly believe it does. A new Senate, a reformed House of Commons would bring democracy and equality and the influence of Canada's diverse provinces much more into the center of national decisions. That will move the whole country forward. An improved division of powers and a clear determination to end the abuse of the federal spending power would make our country more efficient, more effective, more responsive to local needs and priorities. That would move the country forward. Saying to Quebec that it is wanted here, letting Quebec say to the rest of Canada that it wants to stay here, that's an improvement. That would move the whole country forward. Treating Aboriginal Canadians with the respect that comes with responsibility can move the whole country forward. And approval of this accord can get the Constitution out of the headlines, off our TV sets, into the background, where it belongs. That would move this whole country forward, too. Let me deal directly with two arguments put forward by people who want to kill the Charlottetown Accord. The first is that this agreement is really not an agreement at all, that it simply sets the stage for more talk, more debate. And second, because of that, Canada would be better off if we froze reform and stuck to the status quo for at least the life of another parliament. That's to say, at least 5 years. That first argument is false, and the second is foolish. The second pretends that problems go away when you ignore them. Well, not in the real world, they don't. Let me be clear. This accord contains a firm agreement on each of the major constitutional issues of the last decade. A firm agreement on the amending formula, on the division of powers, on Senate reform, on the distinct society, on the social and economic union, on the inherent right to self-government within Canada. Firm constitutional agreements. Now, does that mean discussion would end? Do we tear out the tongues of the lawyers? Of course not. Discussion, that must be some reassurance to some of you. Discussion is going to go on, but it would not be divisive debate over what changes we want. It would be deliberate discussion to give effect to the changes we have agreed. Right now, for example, today, Alberta is continuing to discuss an immigration agreement with Ottawa. British Columbia might want a new agreement on tourism or on training. Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal Canadians would sit down to discuss arrangements for Aboriginal self-government. The Charlottetown Accord reflects a new partnership. Partners talk. That's how successful countries work. That's certainly how federations have to function. That's life. To reject this agreement because it would encourage dialogue is simply bizarre. But even more bizarre is the suggestion that the way to solve our problems is simply to stop talking about them. It assumes those problems aren't real. Well, ask any Canadian Métis how real the Aboriginal problem is. Or indeed, ask anyone who suffered on any side through the agonies of OCA. Ask any Canadian taxpayer how real is the problem of two governments with one tax base competing with each other to deliver the same service to the same people. Ask any Quebec Canadian tempted to separate how real the unhappiness is in Quebec. Ask any Calgarian how real was the National Energy Program. I'm not aware of a single law of politics or of life or of logic that says problems disappear when people ignore them. I am aware of many places where problems got worse, where they were ignored, like the old Soviet Union, like Bangladesh, like Bosnia or Belfast or Bangladesh, like Lebanon. Does anyone pretend that we could take that novel approach, ignoring a problem, saying it'll go away, to any other issues? If we ignore the deficit, will it go away? If we ignore the holes in the ozone layer, will they go away? If we ignore AIDS, will it go away? Of course not. And neither can we ignore constitutional issues which threaten to pull this country apart. Look, we've put off reform in Canada for too long and for too many. Should Western Canadians be told to wait another decade for Senate reform? Should Ottawa be able to continue to abuse the spending power, continue to waste money in areas where the provinces can do a better job? Should we wait another decade, before returning dignity and responsibility to Aboriginal Canadians? Do we want more OCAs, more suicides, more shame? And do we dare let the corrosive doubts deepen about whether Quebec wants Canada, whether Canada wants Quebec? Waiting will not make this go away. Waiting will make this worse. What do you think the reaction would be among investors, among employers on Wall Street, in Tokyo, and Hong Kong, if all that Canadians did this year was to schedule another crisis, a worse crisis, for 5 or 6 years down the road? This isn't a choice between the Constitution and the economy. There is nothing that would improve our economic prospects more than resolving the Constitution. And there is nothing that would harm our economic prospects more than delaying that until some other day. We've been at this now for over 25 years. That's too long. We've postponed reform too many times before. We literally cannot afford to do that again. In a world that grows tougher with each day, we have everything to lose by growing smaller, everything to gain by remaining large. At a time when the challenges facing us are complex and difficult, we have nothing to gain by letting our partnership collapse, everything to gain by making it work better. It's time to get on to other priorities, but before we can do that, Canadians have to solve this, we have to choose, we have to come together. We need each other here in this country. We need each other more than ever, and more than the Constitution. We need each other tomorrow, too, in a world that's going to get tougher. If we can't agree on Canada, would we in this country of diversity and size ever be able to agree on anything else that was important again? And if we can't agree on our country, would anything else matter after that? But if we can agree, what's that mean for our future? In the end, this is not just a national choice. It's also a personal choice, one that each Canadian must make about your country. I'm only one Canadian, but I made my decision a long time ago. I am very proud of my roots in the Alberta foothills, but I believe I am lucky to live in a large country of large vision. I'm proud of my province, but I believe that Alberta is better off as part of a bigger community. I'm proud of Quebec, and I believe it helps make Alberta strong, just as Alberta helped make Quebec strong too. I'm proud of Canada, the more so because I have seen, as Foreign Minister, seen firsthand the good example Canada gives the world of the way that different people with different traditions and views can grow together. We're part of a large family here, a family with differences like any other. We are not identical twins. No one wants us to be. We are brothers and sisters in the most successful community in the world, and we have a family to keep or to lose. That's our decision now, your decision. I pray the decision we make will be one that we and the world and the generations that follow will come to respect and not to regret. I'd be pleased now to try to deal with questions that you might raise, and thank you for your attention.
That's the Right Honourable Joe Clark, Minister responsible for Constitutional Affairs, in a speech given this morning to law students here at UBC. As he said there, Mr. Clark went on to answer a number of student questions from the floor, but because of time constraints here on the program and because the people asking questions didn't have microphones and so can't be heard on the tape, we will not broadcast the remainder of this morning's session. We're almost out of time here on the program, but before we go, we can have a quick look at the weather forecast for you. And well, yeah, that's how we wrap up the program normally. For tonight, few clouds is the forecast, lows down to about 7 degrees and just a 10% chance of precipitation. Outlook for tomorrow calls for mainly sunny skies, few clouds around as well, and highs to about 18. And for Saturday, mainly sunny skies, highs to 18. There is, however, a 30% chance of precipitation on Saturday. Outlook for Sunday and Monday. Sunday, cloudy with a chance of showers, but Monday, and Tuesday and next week, a return to sunny skies and cool but not cold conditions like we've had this week. After speech this morning, Mr. Clark was talking to several members of the media as we scrummed around afterwards, all trying to get a few questions into him. And at one point he said, relax, he'd be back out here in BC a lot and have lots of time to speak to the media and try and convince them that they should vote, or that everybody should vote yes in the question that's coming up in October. So in a couple of weeks or so, we may get another shot at Mr. Clark. And of course, we'll try and get some questions in and maybe even get a chance to speak to him then. That's about it for the Dinner Report for today, though. Join us again tomorrow at the same time for more news and information about campus and the community at large, and, well, all sorts of interesting stuff. And there is tons on the board, lots of stuff on the assignment desk at the moment. So do stay tuned in the days to come. Lots of new stuff happening around at the moment. I'm Ian Gunn. I'll be here tomorrow. Hope you will be, too. We'll talk to you then.